I should start by warning you that this is my moderate talk. My radical talk, I would be proposing the abolition of all government. And maybe I'll do that next year. But for the moment, what I want to start with is a point that law students and lawyers and law professors don't think about and should. And that is the sense in which the modern legal system is redundant. We've got two mechanisms called criminal law and tort law, which really are doing the same thing in different ways. In each case, you do something bad to somebody, the legal system intervenes, something bad happens to you, that's a reason not to do bad things. And the case was rather strikingly demonstrated when O.J. Simpson was first acquitted of the crime of killing his wife and then convicted of the tort of killing his wife. The essential difference between the two systems, in my view, is that in criminal law, all crimes are treated as offenses against the state, not against the victim. It may not have occurred to you, but nobody in this room, at least if you stay in the U.S., will ever be the victim of a crime, legally speaking. Because if somebody murders you or mugs you or robs you, when the case gets to court, it is the state of California versus Smith, not you versus Smith. And that I think, is the essential difference between criminal law and tort law, because in tort law, the victim is treated as the actual victim, and it is the victim or his agent who actually controls the prosecution, does or doesn't accept a settlement. They call settlements plea bargains in criminal law, whereas in criminal law, it is the state that conducts the prosecution, the state that decides whether to settle, the state that collects the fine, and so forth. So I think that's the essential difference, though there are obviously lots of other differences that many of you know about or will know about between the way the two systems work. And so that raises the interesting question, do we need both? Could one have a working legal system in which there was no tort law, only criminal law, or no criminal law, only tort law? We know the answer to that question, because there are, in fact, historical examples of both of those. If you look at the legal system of Imperial China, which existed for a very long time, there was nothing corresponding to our tort law. You lend somebody money, he doesn't pay you back. All you can do is to go to the district magistrate and accuse him of being a swindler. The case is now in the magistrate's hands, not in your hands. Now, it turns out, if you look at that system more carefully, that you really get something very much like tort law happening under the forms of criminal law. And if any of you attend my class next semester on legal systems very different from ours, you will find out all about that and many other weird and interesting things. But the system that actually interests me much more and that got me first interested in odd legal systems is not that, but the system of Saga period Iceland about 1,000 years ago. And that was a legal system where if you killed somebody, his relatives sued you. So that was the example of the pure tort system. It functioned for about a third of a millennium. It's true the last 50 years were pretty bad. On the other hand, the U.S. system arguably broke down within a century of being created with the Civil War, which was, if anything, even worse than the conflicts in Iceland when that system was breaking down. So it's an interesting system. If you're interested, I can point you at more information. So the question then is, are we better off having both criminal and tort law, or would we be better off with only one of them? And the side of that I'm going to be arguing today is that we'd be better off with a pure tort system in which you abolish criminal law and make such modifications to tort law as are necessary to deal with the problems that it raises. And that's essentially the question. And there are two halves to that argument. One of them is, do we need criminal law? That is, are there problems which tort law can't deal with and which you need criminal law to deal with and which it does deal with? And the second question is, if we don't need it, nonetheless, it might still be desirable, it might do a better job, so are we better off if we abolish criminal law and switch to a pure tort system? And at least for today, I'm going to be arguing that we would be, and I think that may be true. I'm not certain it's true. I'm certain of very few things in this world, but I think it's a sufficiently good case so that it's worth making and thinking about. All right, so I'm going to start by going through the problems that would face, or that people might argue would face, a pure tort system. And the first one is what's always struck me as the weakest argument in favor of the criminal law, although it's one you often see. And that's the claim that the reason that when you are mugged, it ends up as the state of California versus Smith is that your being mugged puts other people in fear, and therefore the state is acting on their behalf as well. Now, to begin with, that doesn't explain the difference between criminal law and tort law, because when somebody runs into my car, other people might also be afraid of having their cars run into. Furthermore, if you are concerned with that problem, that's an argument for tort law, not against it. Because if somebody robs me and it's handled in the criminal system, he's caught, convicted, goes to jail, and I get nothing. Whereas if the same thing were handled in the tort system, if my suit succeeded, I would get compensation. Well, I'm less scared of something happening if there's a chance of being compensated than if there isn't a chance of being compensated. The extreme version of that is the bumper sticker, hit me, I need the money. So from that standpoint, insofar as that's an argument, it's an argument in the other direction. Let me now go on to what seemed to me to be the more serious issues. And the first one is, what if the victim of a crime is too poor to afford a lawyer? A problem which exists with tort law at present as well, victim of a tort. The Icelanders solved this problem 1,000 years ago. And they solved the problem because in their system, tort claims were transferable. So the equivalent of being too poor to afford a lawyer is that I'm an elderly man, I have one son, and somebody kills him. The guy who kills him is a big, tough guy. And if I try to go to court and go through the legal procedures to get a wehrgeld, to get the damage payment for killing, he's going to beat me up on the way to court. How do I solve that problem? The way I solve that problem is that my neighbor has four tough sons who went a Viking in their youth and lots of friends and relatives and allies. I transfer the claim to him, because tort claims are transferable. He goes through the legal procedure, collects 200 ounces of silver, and splits the money with me. So by making tort claims transferable, you solve the problem of the poor victim. And indeed, I have long argued that this is a respect in which modern American law is a mere 1,000 years behind the cutting edge of legal technology. Because if you think about our tort law system, there would be quite substantial advantages to transferable, marketable tort claims. Not only do you have the problem of the poor victim, nowadays, conceivably, he might get somebody to take it on a contingency fee, but if he takes it on a contingency fee, the poor victim has no way of knowing which lawyer will do the best job for him, or which lawyer might sell him out. Whereas if tort's claims are marketable, he just sells his claim to the highest bidder, and that tells him who it's worth most to, and therefore who's most likely to collect. So it also provides a better solution than current class actions to the class action problem, but that would be a different talk, so I won't go into that now. All right, so that's the solution, I think, to that problem. The next solution is the poor offender. Assume the offender does not have the assets to pay the damage payment that the court awards against him. And that's really two problems. And the first one is that that means that there is no penalty, since he's not paying anything. Consequently, there's no deterrence. Consequently, the system doesn't work. And there are at least two solutions for that problem, both of which I am again borrowing from saga period Iceland. One of them is that you back up the tort system with criminal penalties. So in the Icelandic system, if you owe a wehrgeld or owe some other penalty and you don't pay it, the result is that you become outlawed, and if you're outlawed, anybody can kill you. That's a fairly strong incentive. The modern American system, I think, would not go quite that far, but you could certainly imagine a system where the damage payment judgment against you is 2 years or $20,000. If you pay $20,000, you go home. If you don't pay $20,000, you spend the next 2 years in prison. So that would solve the deterrence problem. You're backstopping it with a criminal penalty. It also means that people are more likely to pay because they don't just get off free if they can't pay the money. The alternative is, which the Icelanders also had, is some system in which people work off their fines. So that in the Icelandic system, it was referred to as debt thraldom. A thrall was a slave. and the debt thrall was a temporary slave who owed a damage payment to somebody and was working for him to work that off. And when I originally got interested in Iceland and wrote a journal article about it, I suggested what seemed to me at the time a good version of that in the modern American system. And the version of that is you're sentenced to 2 years or $10,000. You can sit in prison, in this existing government prison, for 2 years if you like, but you can also accept a bid from a private prison which offers to let you work off the fine inside that prison at some rate they agree to. You get to decide whose bid you accept and whether or not you'd rather just sit in the government prison. If you think that the terms being offered are more attractive than sitting in government prison, you work off your fine. Now, there are some problems with that, which I'm going to come back to later. But for the moment, that would be the modern equivalent of death row. Now, those are ways of solving the first problem of no deterrence. But the second problem is that if I'm not going to collect anything, why am I going to bear the cost of figuring out who did it, prosecuting in the court and so forth? And in particular, if I expect that the result of 2 years or $20,000 is he's going to sit in the prison and not work for 2 years, then I'm not going to bother to go after him in the first place. The same situation is when somebody dents your car and after a little investigation you discover he has no insurance, no assets, and you're going to lose money if you try to collect. So how do you solve that problem? And that's particularly a problem, if you think about the kind of things which are commonly criminal, if you have an offense where finding out who did it and proving it is moderately costly, and where you often fail. That is, you are not going to actually convict all robbers or even catch all robbers. Well, if I say to myself, it's going to cost me $5,000 of lawyer's fees to catch this guy and convict him, and I only have one chance in four of doing it, and if we convict him, he can only pay a $5,000 damage payment, that looks like a pretty lousy deal for me, all right? Because I'm going to get one chance in four of collecting $5,000, and I'm going to lay out $5,000 doing it, losing bet. So the obvious solution to that, and a solution which various people have speculated about why it doesn't exist in tort law, would be to have probability multipliers. To say if you have an offense where you only have a 50% chance of catching somebody for that kind of offense, the tort damage is twice the damage done, twice the amount that makes the victim whole, so that on average he collects what was taken from him, as it were. We do that in criminal law all the time. We don't call it a probability multiplier. But if you've got a $100 fine for throwing a Coke can out of your car while driving down the road, nobody seriously believes that one Coke can does $100 worth of damage. The reason that the penalty is that high, I think the penalty for running a red light, I saw a sign when I was driving down San Tomas yesterday, I think it's $350 at least, $375. So don't run red lights around here. It's not when cops are watching. So you do have probability multipliers in criminal law. And that raises the interesting question of why you don't have them in tort law. And if you had them, that might solve the problem. The problem then is that you have the probability multiplier. So now the guy who stole $5,000 from you owes a $20,000 fine, which is even less likely he can pay. All right? So aside from some other problems with that, which, again, I'll come back to, it's not a very satisfactory solution because it makes the judgment proof problem even more serious. What alternatives then are there? One of them is that you combine the tort system with a bounty system. So the state says essentially, all right, he's been sentenced to 2 years or $10,000. He doesn't have any money and won't pay it. He spends 2 years in prison and we give you a $10,000 bounty. After all, in my system, the state is saving all the money they now pay to policemen since the enforcement is being done privately rather than by state employees, so they should be willing to reward you if you can't collect the money. That would be one possibility. I'll be talking a little bit later about 18th century England, which is my other historically interesting case, because that was a system which on paper was just like our system, except for the small detail of no police and no public prosecutors. in that system, for some crimes, they had rewards for successful prosecution from the crown. So that would be an example of the equivalent of my bounty system. But there's actually another interesting feature of the English. In fact, I better tell you a little bit about that. England in 18th century had our legal system. That's where we got it from, after all. However, essentially all criminal prosecution was private. Any English citizen could prosecute any crime. It was not a tort system. They also had tort law as well. But the criminal system was one in which if you successfully prosecuted the guy who stole your horse, you got the horse back, presumably, but he ended up being hanged, transported for 14 years indentured servitude in the New World, or being pardoned and sent home. Or being pardoned on condition to agreeing to enlist in the Army or Navy if there was a war on. It's an interesting system. I can point you at where you can learn lots more about it. But one puzzle that it raises is why anybody prosecuted. Because with a tort case, you're prosecuting in order to collect a damage payment. But with the criminal case, you prosecute, and even if you win, you aren't getting anything. And there are a couple of interesting answers. One answer is you prosecute in order to be paid to drop the charges. This was illegal, and there's a good deal of evidence that happened quite a lot. I could go into that in more detail. But the other reason is that you prosecute in order that other people won't rob you. We're used to thinking of deterrence as a public good, that when you prosecute a criminal, the idea is to deter all crimes against everybody. But in a private prosecution system, the reason I prosecute a criminal is to deter crimes against me. And that works if I'm a repeat player. If you imagine that I've got some kind of a business that is at continuous risk of being robbed, then it would make sense that when we do when I think we can catch somebody, we catch him, we prosecute him, he gets hanged, and nobody robs my store again. Now, this is not just an 18th century system. You may have noticed that some stores have signs saying we prosecute shoplifters. All right. Well, they don't literally prosecute shoplifters because it's a crime, not a tort. They mean we encourage the police to prosecute shoplifters. But again, the point is that they want the reputation that will deter people from stealing from that store. So one possible motive for prosecuting in a privately prosecuted system, which includes both the English privately prosecuted criminal law, but also what I'm proposing, which is a privately prosecuted tort law, where sometimes you can't collect because the guy has no money, another incentive to do it would be private deterrence. In the English case, by the way, the way they solved the problem that what if you're not a repeat player? What if you're somebody who might get robbed, you know, once every 20 years, by which time they will have forgotten the last time? Their solution to that was something called an Association for the Prosecution of Felons. And this was a group of people who had an annual fee which went into a pool of money which was used to prosecute anybody who committed a felony against any of them. And the list of members of the association was published in the newspaper for the felons to read. Right? It's a way of pre-committing to prosecute. Because after you're robbed, it's not in your interest to prosecute. It's going to cost you money. You're not going to get anything. But before you're robbed, it's in your interest to have people know you will prosecute. So you pay in advance into your association of felons. There were thousands of these. There were a lot of these. They were mostly local, of course, because the felons in London aren't going to know whether you're a member of an association in New York. I should say I've been teaching a course every other year here, and I'm teaching it the next semester on legal systems very different from ours. And it's been a lot of fun, sort of, from my standpoint, learning about many things much more exotic than this, but we could get into that next semester. So in any case, so one possibility then is the possibility of private deterrence as the incentive which motivates your prosecution. Now, there's one more problem that I didn't list, and that's the problem of fraudulent prosecution. When I originally proposed my idea of having people work off crimes, I thought it was a great work off criminal, tort damages for what we now call crimes, I thought it was a great idea. And I was discussing it online a very long time ago, because I've been online for a very long time, and spend too much of my time there. And Somebody said, yeah, the colonial powers had that system in Africa. They wanted a road built, so they found some excuse to arrest a bunch of people, and their penalty was working on the road. And it struck me that he had a real point there. That is to say that everything I'm saying works fine as long as you can trust the legal system to work, to only convict innocent people. But you can't trust any legal system to only convict innocent people. You have to worry about the incentives in the system. And one of the risks of a system where if I prosecute you, I get to collect damages from you, is the risk that people will, in a corrupt system, prosecute innocent people in order to collect damages. We worry about that in the tort system at present, that, as I assume all of you will know, when you are hired to prosecute a tort, the first question you ask is who has the deepest pockets? Because not who is most guilty, because winning a case against somebody with no money doesn't do you any good, and winning a case against somebody much less guilty who has money does do you some good. So we worry about that. We have to worry about it in the criminal law as well. The case which I think got improved in this state quite recently, one of the few things our governor has done that I approve of, is civil forfeiture. That in general, under current law, if property is used in the commission of a crime, it forfeits. In order to forfeit it, you do not have to prove that a crime actually occurred. This is a civil case in which they are suing the property, not the owner. They do not have to believe the owner is guilty of anything at all. It could have been used without his permission in a crime. And it is then up to him. They only have to prove to the civil standard of proof that it was used in a crime. And the result, of course, is the police have an incentive to go after. I mean, the notorious cases are ones where they stop somebody driving, they find that he's got a whole lot of money on him, they say, obviously, you wouldn't have this money if it weren't for a drug crime, and we won't actually put you through all of the mess of arresting you for a hypothetical drug crime and having you go through all of the costs, but we're keeping the money. And in principle, the guy who's just had his money stolen can sue them, and once in a while, he can succeed in getting the money back. If you want to donate money or to do volunteer work, the Institute for Justice is a libertarian public interest law firm which handles such cases. But it's clearly a perverse incentive. So you do have to worry about that. And I, in fact, wrote a journal article called The Inefficiency of Efficient Punishment, in which I was pointing out that an efficient punishment, namely one where what the person punished loses, somebody else gets, looks like a great idea. That's an advantage of fines over imprisonment because there's no net cost then, but it's got the risk of giving incentives to convict innocent people. So that's, I think, the most serious issue, and we could discuss that at more length. But it's really an issue for both tort and criminal law. The other version of the criminal equivalent of that is that you frame person A in order to compel person A to give possibly perjured testimony against person B, who's the one you really want to get. And there was a scandal of that sort in Philadelphia some years ago where it turned out that the police had been doing that pretty extensively. So you have to worry. In general, one of the things that's missing in a lot of law and econ stuff, which is my specialty really, is thinking about the incentives of the enforcers. That we think about the incentives of criminals, we think about the incentives of victims, but we don't think enough about what are the incentives of police and judges and legislators and all the people on the enforcement side who are no more to be trusted a priori than anybody else. That is, the proper economic view of these things is to think of everybody as engaged as acting on rational self-interest, where self-interest is pretty broadly defined. It includes caring about things other than yourself, but not caring about everybody. And we ought to apply that standard to police as well as to criminals. That's a digression, but I think an important digression. In any case, so now one way you can at least reduce some of this problem is to borrow a legal institution not from England or Iceland, but from Athens. Because in Periclean Athens, if you did their equivalent of a tort suit and you lost, you owed damages to the guy you had sued. You owed a proportion. I think it was a sixth of the amount you would claim from him. Now, we don't know enough about the Athenian legal system to be sure if this applied to all tort cases or only some tort cases. But at least for some subset of tort cases, that happened. And again, I've argued that would make some sense in our system, that if you sue somebody who is innocent, there is some risk that you will win even though he's innocent, because courts make mistakes. That therefore, there ought, in the case where he's acquitted, that's some evidence he was innocent, you imposed a risk on him, and you might owe damages for that. So that would be, again, part of the fun of this stuff on legal systems very different, is figuring out what legal rules we can steal from other societies that might make sense for our society. And the idea of some kind of a damage payment for false suits, I think, makes sense for our society. All right. So far, I've been running through the problems and ways of dealing with them. Let me now go to the other half of the argument, which is the question of why would it be worth doing? That is to say, what are the advantages of replacing criminal law with tort law? And I think there are really two large advantages. The first one is that socialism works poorly. It may not have occurred to you, most people are used to thinking of socialism as either a pejorative term for things you don't like or a term of praise for things you do like, depending on your political views, rather than thinking of socialism as simply a description of a particular kind of institution. And if you use it in the economist sense, socialism is government ownership and control of the means of production. And there are two very large socialist industries in the U.S., one of them is the industry of enforcing law, and the other is the industry of educating K through 12 students. All right, the public school system is a socialist institution, whether that's good or bad, people can argue about, and the system of police and courts is, again, a socialist system. So that what I'm really suggesting is a very partial privatization of the latter system. I think there's quite a lot of evidence historically, as well as quite a lot of economic theory, which suggests that socialism works very poorly. That's why the Soviet Union eventually imploded. It's why things are going very badly in Venezuela at the moment. If that's right, and obviously I'm not going to make that argument here, some people agree with it, some don't, but if you believe that in general governments are pretty bad at producing goods and services, then you would expect that one of the goods and services they're bad at producing is law enforcement. Now, it's also lawmaking, but that would, again, be a different talk. That would be for my radical talk. But if you believe that, then it makes sense to say that on the whole, having a competitive market for the service of catching criminals, where you are basically hiring a lawyer, coon, private detective, or whatever, who will then work for you, bring the guy in and convict him, looks like it's likely to be an improvement. The second reason is that our present criminal system has some fairly serious built-in problems. That if you think about how it works, in a criminal trial, the judge works for the government, the prosecutor works for the government, and most of the time the defense attorney works for the government. Because as you may know, in a sizable majority of all felony trials, the felon is considered indigent, the defendant, not yet a felon, is considered indigent. He therefore has a defense attorney provided for him by the state. Those vary enormously. Some of them are obviously idealistic people who are working as public defenders and doing their best for their clients. Others are people who have bribed the judge by making campaign contributions to be appointed a defense attorney on the grounds that although they aren't paid very much, they can always do less work than that and do. So you have a system where for a considerable majority of the cases, everybody in the case is directly or indirectly working for the same employer, for the government. And that's a rather scary situation if you think about it seriously. Let me go back to the English system, because one of the interesting questions about 18th century England is why they didn't have police and public prosecutors. It wasn't that the idea wasn't around. The French had them. Now, that might be why the English didn't, of course. But the English had them in Ireland, if I remember correctly. And I think part of the answer is that if you look at English history, the 17th century consisted of a civil war followed by a military coup followed by a military dictatorship for, I think, 14 years until Oliver Cromwell died, followed by another coup which brought back the Stuart king, followed by another coup which threw out the brother of the Stuart king when he died because he was Catholic and they didn't want a Catholic king, and brought in a somewhat more distant relative to... They call this the Glorious Revolution, by the way, if you do English history. It may have occurred to people at that point that if the crown controls prosecution, the king's friends can get away with murder. This is not a purely hypothetical case for either them or us. Let me start with the case that first struck me. I was a graduate student in Chicago, and this would probably be in the late 60s, I think, when there was an interesting incident where a group of policemen came to the door of an apartment at night occupied by sleeping Black Panthers and opened fire and killed two people. The police claimed they had been shot at first. The Panthers denied it. And I commented to a left-wing friend of mine that I believed neither the police nor the Panthers. I saw no reason to trust either. And her reply was to tell me that the Panthers were offering guided tours of the apartment. So I went and looked. And it turns out that when a bullet goes through a wall, you can tell which way it was going by the way the splinters point. And it was all incoming. There was never any evidence brought out that anybody had shot at the police. The police had committed first-degree murder, as far as I can tell. Maybe you could argue, maybe they thought there was a shot, and so it wasn't first-degree murder. No policeman was ever charged with any crime in that case. The district attorney involved was charged with obstruction of justice, but acquitted for trying to conceal the facts of the case. However, the survivors sued and got an out-of-court settlement from, I think, the city and the county and maybe the state, which was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, which at that time was real money. So that struck me as an interesting case. There are a number of other cases since then in our system that one could discuss, but the most recent one may be one that you're aware of. It's not quite as extreme as killing people. But as you may know, James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, committed open deliberate perjury before Congress. He was asked the question, this is testimony under oath, he was asked, does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? And he responded, no, sir. This is before the Snowden revelations, at which it became clear that they indeed did collect quite a lot of data on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans. He later said his answer was erroneous. He had been given the question a day before to look at, so it wasn't like he was surprised. It is about as clear a case of perjury as one can imagine having. He was never charged, of course. In fact, he wasn't even fired. All right? So I think all of these cases and a number of others I could discuss, but I don't think I'm going to go into, illustrate the problem that because criminal law is controlled by the state can choose not to prosecute people who commit crimes that are gruesome. Let me go back to 18th century England, because it turns out there's some really interesting stuff, which I only discovered fairly recently, related to this. Does anybody here know who John Wilkes was?
Booth?
No. The person who John Wilkes Booth was named after. All right. He's probably the most interesting person you've never heard of. He's also the person who Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, is named after. John Wilkes was a radical journalist and politician in 18th century England who, over the course of his career, was an outlaw, a prisoner, a member of Parliament, and Lord Mayor of London. And he essentially fought a decades-long feud with King George, in the course of which he, among other things, created the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution in England. That is to say, there was a case where a bunch of their equivalent of Secret Service agents, King's Messengers, they were called, went out with a warrant saying you can arrest anybody or seize anything that you believe is connected with the following crime, the crime being the publication of an anti-government magazine. And Wilkes and his people sued and collected a sizable damage payment from the Secretary of State and his people on the grounds that a warrant that did not name the person being sought was not legal under English law. So they established that principle, and that's the principle in the Fourth Amendment, part of the Fourth Amendment, which says that it's got to be, you've got to have a named warrant. But But Wilkes did a whole bunch of interesting things. He was a crazy, supposed to be the ugliest man in London, in England, but also the most successful seducer in England. He claimed, I think, that with half an hour's lead, he could be more successful in that project than the handsomest man in London. There are lots of stories about Wilkes. There's a good biography of him. He's the sort of guy who went into debt, did extravagant things, but people who knew him liked him. One of the ways I originally got onto him was Boswell, who's mostly known as a biographer, but who was an 18th century person who kept the diary that we've got, which is quite interesting. And Boswell's political principles were the opposite of Wilkes, but he met him and really liked him a lot, which impressed me. Anyway, Wilkes is in prison. This is in London, which was largely sympathetic to Wilkes and his views. This is before he was Lord Mayor of it. There's a mass demonstration. The troops get nervous and fire on the demonstrators and kill several people. The Wilkes people prosecute for murder several soldiers and the justice of the peace who gave the order to fire. They don't convict them, but they do prosecute them. They do it. Well, one of the soldiers jumps bail, probably the one who was actually guilty, most provably guilty. And the justice of the peace apparently faints twice during his trial because he's being tried in London, where the jury is likely to be sympathetic to the other side, does not actually get convicted. But it sort of nicely illustrates the fact that when prosecution is not controlled by the crime, it becomes at least possible to use the criminal system against state actors rather than only for them. Now, they still have the problem the king had the power to pardon. If I was telling you more about 18th century England, there's an interesting bit about that as well. But I think that nicely demonstrates the problem. So the basic argument I'm making is that it would be a freer society, a society in which the state had less power, if you had a mechanism in which prosecution for crime was not under the control of the state, and that what I am proposing, replacing criminal law by tort law, is a way of getting that result. Let me mention, since I'm giving this talk to law students, that when you're thinking about crime and tort, aside from my proposal, there are a bunch of interesting questions that people mostly don't think about and probably should. And one of them is the way in which we currently decide what's prosecuted as a crime and what is a tort make any sense? Is there a logic to it? Is it just historical accident? If there is a logic to it, what is it? Similarly, we have different legal rules. We've got a different standard of proof in tort law. We've got a requirement of intent in criminal law, theoretically, with a few exceptions. Do those things make any sense? I have a book, Law's Order. And you don't even have to buy it because the book is webbed on my webpage. I write books mainly so people will read them, not mainly as a source of income. And I discuss these issues in a chapter there. Or, of course, you could take my law and econ course, which is the other course I'm teaching next semester, in which I think they call it Economic Analysis of Law, in which Law's Order will be the textbook, and in which we're covering a whole bunch of this sort of stuff. The sources for more stuff, my website is daviddfriedman.com. That's pretty easy to remember. It would be davidfriedman.com if I'd applied for the domain about 4 months earlier, but someone beat me to it. And that's got Law's Order. Chapter 18 is specifically on the crime-tort puzzle. The legal system is very different from ours. I am in the process of writing as a book. The draft of the book is up on my webpage for comments. It tells you a whole lot more about 18th century England and Iceland than I've covered here. There are additional, my old articles, one of them which is on the Icelandic case, one of them which is related to the controversy over private enforcement, was basically which I was arguing with Landis and Posner about many years ago. One of them is on 18th century English law, and one of them is on the problems of efficient punishment, which could be another talk, but isn't at the moment. All right, that's what I have to say. It's now David's loss to tell you why it's all wrong.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be able to comment on Professor Friedman's ideas, because he's always got very interesting ideas, creative approaches to problems, and good stories to go along with it. So makes it for a very entertaining presentation. I'm going to just say a couple things. I mean, I feel like, it's sort of an odd position for myself because I'm often the one who's telling you everything, what's wrong with the status quo and letting somebody else defend the status quo. But since he's telling you what's wrong with the status quo, I sort of feel like I have to respond by defending the status quo a little bit. So I want to suggest that one of his starting premises is that tort law and criminal law are designed to do similar things. And I think that there's an important sense of they're designed to do very different things. So if we think about tort law, we generally say that we're doing two things with tort law. One is deterring wrongdoers, and one is compensating victims, right? When we talk about criminal law, I think we're doing sort of four different things with criminal law. One is deterring wrongdoers, and so there's clearly a lot of overlap between what we're doing with criminal law and what we're doing with tort law. And I think if you look at these solely on the level of deterrence, then Professor Friedman makes some interesting arguments here about why we might be able to do a better job with tort law, particularly if you start playing around with tort law. But other than that, other things that we're trying to do with, I'm not spelling it right, but that's all right, incapacitate offenders, right? If someone is dangerous, one of the reasons we put them in prison is so that they don't go out and commit more crimes, right? Interestingly, I think Professor Friedman's proposal tries to sort of bring this into the tort system by saying, well, there is an option here for somebody who doesn't pay off their damages to be put in prison if they can't afford to pay damages. So that is doing some of the incapacitation function, which we don't usually think of as part of the tort system, but essentially under his proposal, he would be bringing that element of criminal law into the tort system. But it would only apply to people who can't afford to pay. So then, in effect, right, what we end up with is criminals who can afford to pay can go out and do more crimes if they're not deterred, right? And criminals who can't afford to pay are basically locked up so that they can't go out and do more crimes. So that strikes me as somewhat problematic. Another thing that we at least sometimes say we're doing with the criminal system is rehabilitate people. Now, there's a lot of disagreements about whether the criminal system really does that, whether it's very effective at doing that, but at least that is a sort of a goal or a stated goal of the criminal law system, which is really quite different from the tort system. I didn't hear anything in this talk that really gets at how we sort of rehabilitate offenders. Maybe what you're suggesting about, you go work for a particular person and you do labor for that person to sort of pay off your debt could be seen as a type of rehabilitation or a form of rehabilitation. But I think if we want to spin this out a little more, we'd have to think about a little bit more about sort of rehabilitation as a goal, because that's one of the things that we at least think we're trying to do with the criminal system. But the probably the main difference here is retribution. And retribution is in the sense of, right, we're making one of the main things we're doing in the criminal system that we're not doing in the tort system is we're making a collective moral judgment about what kind of behavior is morally blameworthy and what kind of behavior is not morally blameworthy. And that collective moral judgment gets expressed through the criminal law by issuing a judgment that says, a court issuing a judgment that says this person is guilty, this person has committed a crime. This is a feature that is unique to the criminal justice system that's not part of the tort system. And now one response to that may be, well, we're not interested in making these kinds of collective moral judgments, but I think that we do as a society, and most societies do, want to do that. We want to express some notion, and this, this may reflect a sort of, libertarian versus non-libertarian view, on these subjects, right? But I think that that the one who's not sort of committed to libertarianism, there's a sense of sort of social solidarity here. And us coming together as a community and expressing a community moral judgment that says this behavior is morally blameworthy, and we as a community are going to pronounce it morally blameworthy by issuing a judgment that emanates from the criminal justice system. You can't do that through private enforcement, right? We're not interested in, I mean, I may be very interested in what one person thinks is morally right or morally wrong, but that is a different kind of thing than a collective judgment on behalf of the community that says what you've done is morally blameworthy and therefore you deserve to be punished for that. And this is sort of an essential feature of the current criminal justice system we have, which I don't think you can replicate in a privatized system. So I'll stop there and, I'll let you respond to any of that, and we open it up to questions,
sure,
depending on what you want to do.
To begin with, I'm not entirely sure why the fact that somebody commits a crime again is a really serious problem if he's fully compensating his victim through a tort system. Now, you can get into various complications of that, but it would seem a little odd just to say, well, it's a terrible thing that people who can afford to compensate the victim can do things. Of course, under the tort system, it's also true that if you can afford to compensate your victims, you can do things. It's true I don't believe in collective moral judgments. I think moral judgments are made by individuals. But I would also point out that you're factually wrong about how our system works, because after all, there are parts of the criminal law, such as speeding tickets and certainly parking tickets, which nobody actually thinks of, maybe speeding occasionally, but mostly most people don't think of those things as giving any moral judgment at all. Furthermore, there is some evidence, I'm not sure it's quite counts as moral judgment, but there's an interesting old piece by John Lott where he looks at firms that have been sued for doing various bad things and what happens to their stock prices. And his conclusion is that the drop in stock price when they are sued is much larger than the largest penalty that they are facing. And that what's happening is a reputational penalty for people believing this may be people you can't trust, rather than just the effect. So I would have argued that, in fact, the relevant kind of stigma, which is not really, I don't know if I'd call it moral, is the reputational effect of having been found guilty. Note, by the way, that since this is my modest proposal, the courts are still being run by the state in this system. And if the courts are still being run by the state, insofar as the state making a judgment of guilt conveys any moral implication, that's going to still apply. And I notice you didn't mention the fact that the criminal system is missing what you're calling the second half of the tort system, namely compensation, and that's a disadvantage of the criminal system, a way in which the tort system is better. So in incapacitation, my basic answer is, if they can pay for their crimes, why does it matter much if you incapacitate them? Rehabilitation, I would say that to some extent discovering that you have done damage and have to pay for it is something that's going to make you somewhat a better person. But I'm also very suspicious of the idea that a state which, after putting you through 12 years of state schooling, couldn't make you into a good person, can somehow accomplish it with another couple of years in prison. One of the interesting differences between 18th century and 19th century legal talk is that the 18th century people are much more like us economists, that they assume that criminals are basically rational people who have to be deterred. The 19th century people have got penitentiaries where you're supposed to learn to repent for your sins. They have solitary confinement, lots of religion and hard labor, which are supposed to turn you into a good, productive person. The whole tension between believing in deterrence and believing in rehabilitation has been running for a couple of hundred years now, and it's one of these things where whichever one you believe, it doesn't work, and so you switch to the other one. But I don't think rehabilitation is worth much of that. So I guess those would be my answers. I would agree that all versions of the prison system are uncomfortably close to slavery. Present prison system is slavery. All right. The only difference is that in this system, the slavery is productive slavery rather than entirely unproductive slavery. I don't see that whether the people who are being enslaved are black or white really matters. I think both of them count, have the same moral status, just as whether people who police kill when they shouldn't kill them are black or white, I don't think matters very much. I think the critical question is, are they killing innocent people? So I guess the question is, unless you want to abolish the criminal law and replace it by nothing, you are presumably still in favor for, if anything, you've really turned it around. That is to say, under the present system, you commit something that's now a crime, and assuming you are convicted, you're guaranteed to go to prison, or if it's a serious enough crime, at least. Under my system, you commit something that we now call a crime, but now becomes a tort, and now there is a chance you can pay it off, there, depending partly on the amount. There is a chance you can work it off, and there is a chance that you end up sitting in prison. So it doesn't seem to be making it any worse, and if anything, it's making it a little bit better. Yeah. A couple of things. First, of course, you still have something like the grand jury. You have some process which is necessary to go through in order to convict somebody, grand jury, maybe, and petite jury. You certainly have the possibility of mercy, and in fact, if you look at the 18th century English case, one of the complaints that's made by people who don't think it's working very well is that prosecutors are too willing to let off the people who've done crimes. This is one of the things I haven't really discussed. On paper, essentially all serious crimes were capital. Now, if you actually look at how the 18th century system works, most of the people charged with capital crimes were not actually hanged. First, some of them were acquitted, some of them were convicted of lesser included offenses, sometimes through what was referred to as pious perjury, meaning the jury knows they've really met the condition for the capital version, but they ignore that and find them guilty of the non-capital version. The prosecutor could not prosecute, so you certainly got an option for mercy, and on the whole, I don't know, I'm not sure that I trust public prosecutors any more than private people. But the more fundamental problem, which it's very hard to get around, is that in order to have something happen, people have to have an incentive for it. So the prosecutor is not going to prosecute unless there's some sense in which he's getting rewarded for prosecuting. He's not going to. So if he's being rewarded for prosecuting, that gives the same problem as if he was a private plaintiff. And where there is a big difference is that the state has much larger resources than private people do. And therefore, it is a more nearly unbalanced decision when you've got essentially everybody in the system working for the state, except for the defendant, if he's lucky, his attorney.
I mean, you could sort of read it into tort law, and you could sort of modify that, but it's certainly not like when you take your first year torts class, that's not a feature of tort law that is talked about, and it's not the way tort law is generally looked at, right? Because the primary function is to sort of compensate the victim for harm done to the victim. So, yeah, you've got to show that this person, the wrongdoer, did something wrong in order to cause that harm to the victim. Otherwise, the victim doesn't get compensated, right? But the wrong, notice that the wrong in tort law is very often just a sort of a negligent conduct, right? And negligent conduct, I mean, is, you know, I don't know if we would sort of say somebody that somebody is sort of, you know, we probably wouldn't say somebody's morally defective because they engaged in negligent conduct, right? They were just careless. Now, that's very different than going out and sort of intentionally killing somebody, right, which we would all agree is morally wrong. And actually, one other thing I was going to say, just to, you know, to respond to you, and then I'll sit down again, but there is a big difference here in thinking about crimes against the person and crimes against property. Right? Because crimes against the person carry with them a different kind of moral judgment than crimes against property. So when I'm worried about incapacitation, I'm really worried about incapacitating somebody who has gone out and committed a murder or something like that, where we tend to think that there might be a tendency to go out and do that again, right? Whereas, you know, if the crime is taking a bunch of money from somebody and they pay off the debt, well, okay, they paid off the debt. I don't necessarily feel that I need to sort of put them in prison to prevent them from doing it again. But
I just want to thank you for refuting the argument you just made. That you were arguing a few minutes ago that the moral judgment depended on whether it was a crime or a tort. And you now just observed that our moral judgment depends on whether it's an act against the person or an act against property. And most crimes, after all, are acts against property. Right? Murder is a very small fraction of the total number of crimes. So right and wrong are not made by act of Congress. and people are going to make their moral judgments. And if we had a system in which murder sometimes resulted in the payment of a very large fine, with or without imprisonment to work it off, people who think murder is wicked will still think they're wicked for doing it. And if we have a system as we now do, in which parking in the wrong place ends up with a criminal fine, not in prison, but it's going through the criminal system, not the tort system, nonetheless, people won't think you're an evil person for parking in the wrong place. So I just don't think that mapping the crime tort. But I also want to suggest that really what you're calling retribution is mixing two quite different things. One of them is retribution, which I think is not really a moral judgment. It's the idea that people ought to be punished for doing bad things, as opposed to that they ought to be punished to deter them. But I think the gut feeling of retribution is whether or not it deters you, even if it's a crime you'll never have an opportunity to do again, even if we're not worried about deterrence, still you did something bad should happen to you. That's separate from the issue of what do we think of you thereafter. And it is clear that reputational effects are quite large, quite important. They're one of the things we often ignore in both economics and in law, I think. And there, if you've committed a tort and have been convicted of a tort, people will think you're the kind of guy who commits that kind of tort. If we believe people who commit that kind of tort are bad people we shouldn't trust, they won't trust you. If we believe people who commit that kind of crime are not bad people we shouldn't trust, it won't affect us. So I don't think that those effects really depend on crime versus tort. Well, I thought I was dealing with organized crime. I mean, surely the largest body of organized crime we know of is the one that... the serious answer is I think that organized crime is mostly a myth. That there was a point made by someone a long time ago that if you look at the testimony of people about organized crime in court cases, it divides into two very different things. One of them is a bunch of sort of symbolic stuff about oaths and things, and the other is how they run their business. And if you actually look at how criminal businesses are run, it's almost all small business. It's not that the individual burglar is the employee of some large firm with the capo at the top who's giving him orders. Economists can explain why it's small business, because to run a large firm, you need a lot of information moving up and down in order that the people at the top can monitor their employees. And you really don't want all that information running up and down when what you're doing is against the law, because some of it's going to leak out. I don't really see organized crime in the standard sense as a really serious issue. Now, a lot of the things we associate with organized crime are victimless crimes, like prostitution and drug use, and of course, putting aside this particular talk, I think those things should be legal, and that problem disappears then. I don't really see organized crime as a serious issue. But, you know, if I were giving a talk, I'm an anarchist, of course, it may be obvious. So if I was giving a talk on how a society might look without government, we would then get back to some of those issues. But there's extortion in the sense of threatening to sue somebody in the hope of being paid off, of course, exists under the present system. Why is that more of an issue if carrying out those threats results in your being sued and having to pay large damages or go to jail than it is under the present system? That is, it seems to me you're implicitly assuming that the present system does a better job than this would, and I'm not sure why you assume it. If anything, there's an interesting book going back to organized crime called The Last Testament of Lucky Luciano, which at least is by a journalist who claims that he had an interview with Luciano, who was a major mob figure during the Prohibition, back when he was retired in Italy at the end of his career. And Luciano has a firm, illegal firm. It's one of four firms, and they are a single entity for only one purpose. They've got a pooled sum for buying cops and judges, because that's something where what you want the guy on your payroll, and you don't know which of you is going to come in front of him or which of you he might do it. So it seems to me that if anything, the present system is one in which the potential for crime, which is done via corruption, is much higher than a system where it's the victim himself who's deciding whether to prosecute. And I am teaching two courses next semester, so. And they're both fun courses.